Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
What if you had app.net but made it even more difficult to get started? Now, how much would you pay?
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 209 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we have Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
Alrighty. Okay, so we have no Ask MTJC. We established that, right, Jaime?
Yeah, I don't think there was anything that I saw on the interwebs for us.
No, other than my rants about Beyond Burger being sold out. All right. So we have a couple of fact check things. I just wanted to follow up on what I said last week. I think we probably had this fact check a couple of times now. August 6th, 2014 was our first recording. And I was surprised to find that we actually did a recording less than 7 days shortly after there. The second was published on Tuesday, August 12th, which was my birthday. But so that was like a mere 6 days. So we didn't get quite into our cadence of once a week, you know, recording and then publishing around Saturday or Sunday. If Saturday can't be pulled together. So that's our fact check for last week's episode with Mark and myself. All right. So so our follow-up, we start off with, so we were talking about Greg's talk last week, Mark and I, at the Swift Language User Group, or SLUG, down in San Francisco. And it was basically called Hashing, Hashable, and Hash Values. And what Greg likes to do is he likes to take certain principles out of, you know, whatever, usually in Swift, something, you know, in the standard library or whatever, to talk about it. And so he, in the talk here in the video, which you can watch yourself, he talks about using hashing to do comparisons between different values. And he talks about what hashing actually is, which is kind of cool. Sort of explaining that, you know, hashing is converting something into, converting a set of collections or whatever into some sort of number, and then comparing the number that's resulting from the hash. And also talks about when hashes don't equal each other doesn't necessarily mean that they don't contain the two things that you're comparing aren't the same. It kind of works that if they are equal, then yes, they do match. But if they're not, if they don't match, they're not really, you can't really, it doesn't mean that they're not equal is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, he explains it very well, much better than I just did. But yeah, I definitely recommend, if you're curious about hashing and why we use it, you know, in comparing things together in computer science, it's a good little talk there to sort of get you grounded in what the various things mean. So, and I don't know if the other guys didn't watch it, but does that make sense what I was talking about hashing to you guys?
Yep.
You computer science nerd guys over there.
Makes sense.
All right. So, and the next follow-up is we were talking a couple of weeks ago about HipChat and Slack and how Slack had bought HipChat. And we were comparing, I think what we were comparing two companies, Slack and there was another one, but is it Slack or Atlassian? We were comparing Atlassian. And Atlassian sort of is the one that hasn't used any sort of A funding or what do you call it, VC funding to build up their company. They kind of sort of did it organically, I guess. But Slack here, there's an article posted in TechCrunch confirming that they had, in fact, raised $427 million in VC capital, I guess, to give their, and they have a valuation of $7.1 billion in terms of their value. So quite a good company making waves out there. So have you guys looked at this article at all?
I haven't looked at the article, but yeah, that's a lot of funding. It's I wonder how they're going to justify that $7 billion valuation. Yeah. Do we know if they're profitable? I mean, I don't think they don't have ads, but I guess they sell subscriptions to companies.
Yeah, they sell to teams and large teams and enterprises, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can do so much. You can do a certain amount for free, which is kind of nice. But yeah, I think when people get serious about it, they invest in it. And there's some big companies that are on, as we were looking at the enterprise side, there's like PayPal and IBM and some of the major banks here in Canada use them as well. So, and I'm sure there are plenty of companies in the States that use them as well. I think when you're at an enterprise level, you need to have like, you know, thousands of licenses, maybe hundreds or thousands, you know, so it's worthwhile to pay for the bandwidth, right?
Yeah. Still pretty high valuation. So we'll see what they do with it.
Yeah. So what do you mean by that? Like $7.1 billion, that's what they're supposedly worth if they were to go public or something like that?
Yeah. And of course they're not public. So this is just an arbitrary number was decided upon by the investment bankers who invested in them. But that's the basic idea, is that the company is worth that much money on the open market, which is interesting. So typically for a company that's public, the price to sales ratio, which is basically the total valuation divided by the amount of revenue that they make. So amount of sales is, you know, maybe 10x typically. So this would be implying that they could sustain, said where they have roughly $700 million worth of revenue, which seems pretty high. I mean, it's possible, but it seems pretty high. Now, for growth companies, early stage growth companies, often those ratios are way, way higher because people are investing in the future valuation as opposed to today's valuation. So you can get a much higher price to sales ratio. It's pretty high valuation.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, like, you know, I think a lot of people use it. I think, I've been using it since 2014, but I think we found out about it in 2013 or so, 2012, maybe. That might be around when they started up, I guess. But I mean, like in the article here, it says that people like, and we talked about Facebook is kind of sort of doing their groups, work groups kind of thing. I forget what the actual name of it was. And I never did follow off to find that article I was talking about. But, and Microsoft apparently has a tool now. I think Jaime might have mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, to try and take on this, you know, what Slack is doing. And as we know, we just gobbled up, which to me, I mean, there are a number of other tools like this, I think, but Slack and HipChat are the only two that I kind of know about that are around. And we now know that, you know, HipChat's been gobbled up by Slack, right?
So. Yeah, this article mentions Microsoft Teams, which sort of makes the most sense. They also mention Facebook stuff, which I'm not aware of any serious market penetration that Facebook has had with their Facebook for Workplace or Workplace for Facebook.
Yeah, I forget what
the branding is.
Yeah, actually, I think I did put an article a couple of weeks ago, and we'll put link it in the show notes, of course. But I got a notice about it. I was poking around on Facebook one day, and I got this, hey, try out this Workspace thing. And I went, no. Actually, yeah, no, I tweeted about it because I just sort of said, like, why would I, like, we already trust Facebook so much now. Why would we give them all our work too, right? So, I mean, that's good on Slack. Anyway, we'll see what happens. Maybe one day they'll go public and we can invest in them. Who knows?
Real-time correction to myself. It is okay. Workplace by Facebook.
Okay.
By right. Facebook.
Oh.
So I was pretty close to guessing what it was.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, because the other tool I can think of is Basecamp. I don't know if it's comparable or not.
That's more like a project
like a
management
Jira, Trello kind of thing,
collaboration type thing. Like you can do some real time stuff, but it always seemed like it was less about like instant messaging the way that Slack is.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. This other post here from me again. Follow up here from our folks over at Bloomberg. Mark Gurman posted a video. They had a quick little interview with him talking about how it's been discovered, I guess, somehow that Apple is planning a new low-cost MacBook, and that is to take the place of the MacBook Air in the line. So presumably the low end would be the MacBook itself, and then we have the MacBook Pros. And he was pointing out that people aren't really happy with the effort that Apple put out recently with their MacBook Pro line. He's also anticipating, or he's predicting, or he's found out about a Pro-focused Mac Mini. A lot of people have been talking about Mac Minis, and again, because people are not happy with the MacBook Pro redo with the keyboard issues and all that kind of stuff, and people are they're not quite as fabulous as people would anticipate they would be. The Apple's going to come up with some sort of Mac Mini, I guess, to take on, to sort of give you a Pro device for your desktop, and you go off and find a monitor and whatever, and that's where it's coming from. And also, he mentioned too, really in passing, Jaime, edge-to-edge watch, an edge-to-edge screen on a watch. And I think we were talking about some screen assets that we had seen in I think the iOS 12 SDK. Somebody had, I think it was Rambo, our buddy Rambo, had discovered some images in there. I think it was him, right?
Was that really the watch? I think it was us talking about the iPad at that point.
Well, no, I was talking about the one where there was like a sort of an aspect ratio for an iPhone 10, and then same size as iPhone 10, and a slightly larger one with a notch. But there was also that square asset that I said looked more like a watch to me, with a very narrow bezel.
I mean, an iPad would kind of look like that too, I think, was something we had said.
It was square, though, is what I'm saying. And to me, square made more sense on a watch, right?
Sure, but the button that was on the side looked like it was the sleep-wake button for an iPad versus...
True.
The crown for a watch. Unless it was, again, we don't really know like exactly how those icons are going to be represented, so maybe
they're coming out with an iPad Micro. Who knows?
An iPad on your wrist.
Card size iPad.
But independently of that, I have heard rumors that there are new watches coming that will have a thinner bezel.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Like I said, he just mentioned it in passing, like as he was sort of summing up his talk, right? Mm-hmm. No details, nothing was disclosed in that sense. But interesting. All right, and then so in the next follow up here, Mark has one on two spaces after.
Yeah, so this is just a quick one. We had a discussion a few weeks back about whether it's better to have one space after a period or two spaces after a period, and in the old days we always used to do two, but I guess in the modern day of word processors, you only use one. Well, right. I found an article here, which, now take it with a grain of salt. I haven't actually read the full article, but there's a link to the abstract because it's a journal article that I don't have access to. The article is called "Are Two Spaces Better Than One? The Effect of Spacing Following Periods and Commas During Reading." And according to the abstract, they did the most recent edition of the American Psychological Association manual states that two spaces should follow the punctuation at the end of a sentence. And there have been some studies that show that those who use two spaces following a period showed the greatest overall facilitation from reading with two spaces.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't talk about this last time this subject came up, and we were talking about typesetting in general. But in typesetting, there's a terminology called color, where if you look at a full page of text and you kind of squint at it, right? If there's a lot of gaps between the letters or between the words and stuff like that, that can affect its readability. And you'll see that a lot in cases like newspapers, where like you'll have justified on both sides, which is their standard format. And if you see, like, if you can see like pattern, like your eye will get distracted by patterns of white space as they like zebra stripe down the page kind of thing, right? And so that's one of the things that people do when they're setting up justification and spacing between words. And I would think that because in modern typesetting, using justification on both sides, the spacing between the words will vary as you go across the page based on the length of the words and the number of characters in a particular sentence right before it wraps, right? I think in the case of, we were talking though, like in the reason why I believe that, or I had sort of understood that we used two spaces was, back in the day we had fixed character widths or fixed character sizes in typing because we had the single hammer, right? And each character would be like the same distance apart, and two spaces at the end kind of made it visually, like a visual cue to you that that was the end of a statement. Or did they put two spaces after a comma, Mark?
No, one space after comma, two spaces after period.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe because, you know, commas and periods, if you're reading really quickly, probably look the same. But if your brain saw the double space, you might be a visual cue to you without actually hitting your, you know, your frontal lobe to, that it's there, right? Just a sort of a funny sort of thing. On a sort of sidebar discussion, I was listening to Alan Cross on the ongoing history of new music this afternoon, and he was talking about MP3s. He was actually talking about how the brain works and how music in the various parts of the brain that music affects, the amygdala and a few other places, cerebellum and one other thing I can't remember the name of. They all fire off dopamines when you listen to music, you know, that you enjoy, right? Sort of like, and you know, we all sort of seek dopamine firing off in our brains for various reasons. But he was talking about MP3s versus analog, and somehow, like, he was saying that because of the compression used in MP3s, especially at low bit rates, they don't quite fire as much, or I don't think there was any research into this, but they don't quite fire as much dopamine as if you're listening to an analog recording where all of the, you know, all the bits and stuff is there, you know, or like in a CD where you have a WAV file, which is then compressed down to MP3 to throw it up online, right? But it was interesting that to sort of see, like, from, you know, I was talking about the spaces, you know, between sentences being sort of a visual cue that makes your brain happy to read, you know, or makes Mark's brain happy to read. but the same sort of idea that, you know, like, that we can somehow, without even being cognizant of it, tell the difference between an analog recording and an MP3 based on the fact that not all the data is there, right? Because, you know, we're throwing away data to compress, right? Don't you find that interesting?
I'd have to see the study. I don't know that I buy it.
Well, you can listen to the episode of the podcast, right?
Yep.
So yep. Pretty short. He was talking about a lot of other things, but yeah, it was interesting. And of course, he was sort of saying that, you know, he could tell a difference because he's a music professional. He could tell the difference between a 256 bit rate and a 128 bit rate, but then he sort of follows it off by sort of saying, at least that's what I think I can tell the difference, right?
Yeah.
Which I don't buy for a minute, you know, but it's interesting, like, you know, how some people feel that, you know, vinyl is better, and, you know, because they're listening to the actual analog recording, like there's no missing parts in the audio stream, right? So, and we're talking about some pretty base brain processing here, right? You know, this is like down in the EEPROM of your brain, right?
Well, yeah, more in your ears.
It's your brain that processes the sound, Mark.
Yeah, but can your do your ears have enough sensitivity to tell the difference?
I guess it depends on how much loud rock music you listen to when you're a kid, right?
Well, but even kids with...
No, that's true, actually. As you get older, your ear starts to drop off certain tones as well.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So the range of human hearing is roughly 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz.
Sure.
For perfect hearing. And for a full-grown adult, you know, it's probably, you know, cuts down to like 10 or 12 kilohertz because you lose your high end.
Yeah.
And so a CD is sampled at 44.1 kilohertz. Right. And there's a good reason for that, because there's something in electronics called the Nyquist frequency, which basically says, the Nyquist theorem says that if you sample at a certain rate, then it can completely faithfully represent all frequencies up to half that rate. So, mm-hmm. So when you sample at 44.1 kilohertz, that means you can faithfully reproduce down to 22.05 kilohertz, which is wider than the normal range of hearing for humans.
Okay.
So for a full-grown adult who's got a range down to like 10 or 12 kilohertz or worse even, I kind of have trouble believing that they can hear the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not talking about whether you can hear the difference. It's whether your brain processes it is what I'm talking about here, like or what he's talking about in the case of an MP3 that's sampled. What I'm saying, like, so a CD is a WAV file, right?
Yeah. Has, so an MP3 is a little different. An MP3 is compressed,
right?
So
and they throw away bits that they don't need because they use a lot of averaging in the compression, right?
Sure. MP3 yeah. is a little bit more plausible, but the, you know, the audio files will say, oh, they want vinyl versus a CD. Mm-hmm. Well, if you can't hear the difference, your brain can't do anything different.
Process it, sure, right. Sure. Well, but then there's also the other side of the argument too, that some audio that you perceive is also through your body, right?
But that's very low frequency stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll have to find the study for you then.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a book he was recommending called "This Is Your Brain on Music." That maybe we'll have to look into that one and see if that's where the where this information came from. Because he was talking about neuroscience and a bunch of other things as well. But anyway, we've digressed. But that was still a fascinating conversation, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway. All right, so moving away from the tab versus spaces kind of discussion. All right, so we're into the main. It's me again. This is a quick one, I think. This is from a post that I don't know where I saw this, actually. It's kind of clickbaity that Apple got cored 90 gigabytes of secure files. Some high school student figured out how to download a whole whack of files from Apple, believe it or not. He ended up with 90 gigs over time. Just remember how he did this.
Was this the one who did this to try to press Apple to get a job there?
Yes, I think so. And it's because it sort of says, behind the story, the kid got caught with a 16-year-old trying to break into servers at Apple, which rightfully or not has a reputation for solid security. Yeah, because he was sort of, he was applying for a job and they're like, hey, I managed to hack your servers, so I must be good. You should hire me, right? Yeah. Yes, that's right. The teen's lawyer says the client had a motivation, was infatuation with Apple. The boy did it because he was a fan of the company and hoped to work there someday. Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, interesting. I guess that's when did this happen recently, I guess, right? The article was posted 6 days ago on Naked Security, Sophos.com, ampproject.org. Yeah, interesting story. Just our sort of our bent about people breaking into things and how to break things in. Yeah, so Australian kid. He was from Australia, I guess, right? Australia? Did they name the kid here?
No, if he's that age, Melbourne, yeah. I assume they have the same rules we do about naming minors and, that are involved in crimes, or at least alleged to be involved in crimes.
But lesson to the hackers, though, we've talked about this many times before. So he tried to use VPN and he tried to use Tor and other tools to sort of mask where he was coming from. But I think what happened was, it says here in the story that I think he, at one point, he slipped up and did it in the open. And that's when Apple nailed him and found him. Yeah, they recorded the serial numbers of the MacBooks that launched the attacks. That's pretty stealthy, if you think about it, right? So Apple, Apple's watching you people.
The stealthiest thing here is... the hacking software was found in a folder name, quote, Hacky Hack Hack, which, pro tip for you hackers out there, don't collect all your folder stuff into something obvious. Name it like, tax returns or something.
Yeah. So interesting. I love the fact that Apple was able to find the serial number of them, like notwithstanding your IP addresses and all that kind of stuff, right? So the fact that they were able to track them right down to the serial number of the device they made, right? So that's pretty cool. Hmm. Yeah, and it goes back to, I think we talked about this in one of our first or second shows where we talked about that celeb gate, 3 years or as of a year ago, when the celebrities were all, they found all their stuff in iCloud. And
yeah, that was just a phishing scam, though. That wasn't actually a hack, right?
Yeah, no. Yeah, they managed to get them to release their, I still get those kind of emails all the time, right? So
yeah, but that is a good one. This article mentions it too. And it's like, I understand why they do it, but it seems like it's on the verge of being unethical for them to bring it up, because as Mark mentioned, it was a phishing sort of thing, right? It's like, oh man, can you believe this combination lock got broken into? Yeah, because you left the numbers all over the place and people were able to find them and use them, right? Like, it's not as if, oh, holy smoke, somebody broke into the lock. The lock was doing exactly what it should do if you're not keeping the combination secret.
Yeah, that's true. With your hockey tape with the number written on the back of the lock itself, because that never happens.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it's meant to paint a particular narrative, but it's, I don't know. I definitely do think that, journalists should stay away from using that example and use, real examples. Like the fact that iCloud iCloud backups are not as protected as backups that are on, like your Mac Mini, for example, right? If you use the encrypted backup to restore your device, I think that's a legitimate, security problem. But the CelebGate one is juicy to talk about, but it's not an actual thing. So it wasn't a lapse in security for the security system itself.
Sure. Well, so since we're talking about this iCloud stuff and what have you, the other day, as I think I told you guys on our own Slack, that conference I'm going to in a short while, decided to use Google Photos for their library, right? So, and I'd taken Google Photos app off my Mac or from my iPhone device a long time ago. And I don't know if it just didn't get restored or what have you, but, I wasn't very happy about it when it first came on the scene because it automatically, if you click the sync button right from the get go, it starts syncing your photos right off your phone. And I don't know about you guys, but I use my camera on my phone, not just to take selfies, but also to take, like, if I take a page out of one of my notebooks I want to keep, right, I'll take a picture. If I'm looking at a serial number on a Mac or an asset tag or something like that, I'll take a picture with my phone. Or if I'm depositing a check at the bank and I forgot to scan it before I send it to my accountant, you know, I'll take a picture of the check before I put it in the bank machine. But I don't want that on the cloud. I don't want that on Google, and I don't want it on Apple either, right? So the fact that Google just automatically started, you know, slurping up it's almost like the Facebook contacts thing we talked about before, right? Just slurping up the images. And I think I reached out to you guys in Slack and said, how do I stop this thing, right? So, and it's not very clear, like, where exactly, how you turn off the syncing. You have to dig through a couple of menus. That was the actual solution. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think about, do you guys use your cameras for taking notes that way too? Or do you just do selfies and stuff?
Yeah, I use it for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, not necessarily stuff you want to have out in the open, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, it's somebody, here's an app idea for somebody. I thought about this a few times, and I'm sure people have done this before, but that would be an app that basically could be password protected that would take photographs. I'm sure people have tried to do that in the past, now I think about it. But don't you think that would be a good use of the tech, you know?
Password protected to take the photo?
No, to store the photo. Maybe you want to take some photos that you don't want, you know, necessarily to go up to iCloud or what have you, right? I wonder if you could do that, because do all photo apps use the photo library?
No, they don't have to. In fact, an app I worked on years ago, the Relive app, the first version of it, we had our own photo store that was separate from the camera roll. You could export to your camera roll if you wanted to, but you didn't have to.
Right.
So you could keep all these things separately and independently. And it was password protected. So maybe we were ahead of our time back then.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I think we do that. We do that with, like, a number of apps that I've built over years now. I think about it, we'll take, what I think it's the taking of the photo is what I'm talking about, right? Like, because you have to use the camera SDK to take the picture, right?
And do you, but you don't, it doesn't automatically go into the camera roll when you do that.
Right. Yeah. You can decide where it's going to go.
Yeah.
There's an app idea for you guys. Go nuts. make sure it works with 1Password. That's all I ask. Anyway, so I'm going to shut up now and let Mark, I may talk about Back to My Mac.
Yes, Apple has let folks know that macOS Mojave won't be supporting the Back to My Mac feature. And the other half of this is that people are rather upset that Apple is suggesting some pricier alternatives, such as their Apple Remote Desktop app, which apparently cost $80 from the Mac App Store and only has a 1.5 star review rating, which is not terribly good. Before I go into sort of, like, you know, how can people deal with this in a better way than what Apple has suggested, Tim, maybe you can tell us about your experience with Back to My Mac, because I have all kinds of them.
Before I get into that, I just want to say, so because I was an Apple consultant, I've always been using Apple Remote Desktop, and basically it's a VNC client kind of tool, and you can set it up with multiple LANs. So if you're like a roaming nomad support person, you can actually have different LANs set up there. And, you know, I think if I look at my list of IPs in my copy of Remote Desktop, probably have about 50 or 60 different devices in there. And so with that, you can actually observe what's going on the machine. So you can watch people if they're trying to explain something to them, or you can take over control. So it is kind of, I don't understand the 1.5 star rating, because it should be like a 4 or 5 if you're into that, if you're into supporting people. If you're into spying people as well, I know I've heard of people doing that before, but the price is quite a bit cheaper than it used to be. I think it used to be like a $350 app. So the fact that it's come down to $80 on the Mac App Stores is still, I mean, still pricey. I think they're, admittedly, it's not designed for Joe consumer. It's designed for people who need to do support and that kind of stuff. So I used to use Remote Desktop to manage my servers and stuff like that over VPN back in the day when I had Mac servers out in the wild. But sharing, you know, the sharing extension where you can do screen sharing, I think it's called, in System Preferences sharing. Hang on just one sec here. So yeah, so I think it was around, I want to say Tiger or maybe just before Lion, they added the ability to do screen sharing, which is the same facility. It's just, it uses almost the same tool. So I've been using screen sharing for that. Anyway, that's my story about Remote Desktop. But yeah, no, I've been using Back to My Mac forever. I think you know, and it always worked better when you had a time machine. While you were gone, Jaime, I was just telling Mark about some of the issues I have currently with Back to My Mac. I haven't been able to get it to work since I updated my Bell router a while ago because I have, about a year and a half ago, I have two, so I'm double natted, which basically means that I've got the Bell one and then I've got my time capsule sitting behind, and I didn't bother turning off all the services and stuff like that. So I'm doing double natting, which is not really a secure, it's a secure way of doing it, but it's kind of, it kind of breaks a lot of the automation that happens between routers and switches and hubs and stuff like that. But yeah, so the one story I put on Twitter was that the very first time I went to WWC in 2010, I didn't realize that I needed to have my iPhone backup because I think there was an app or something that you needed to build or something like that and install onto your device, like the, you know, the WWC app or whatever. I can't remember if it was through the App Store. I think it was actually, you had to download it somehow, but you needed to have you needed to drag it over into iTunes. And I didn't bring I brought a backup Mac, but I didn't bring my backup data for my iPhone. It was like a different Mac, right? So I logged on to my computer at home in Toronto and, you know, got onto the screen and basically zipped up, went to the directory where your iPhone backup is, zipped it up, right? And then had it FTP to one of my servers so I could pick it up and did that. Of course, you know, coming from my home machine, it was great. But on the hotel Wi-Fi, it was like glacial speed, right? So I started the download, and Carol and I went and checked out the city for like 4 or 5 hours because that's how long it took to download my backup. It was like 100 meg or something ridiculously small like that. But yeah, and then I was able to continue on doing my work. So I've used Back to My Mac and VNC and Chicken in the VNC and screen sharing forever. So it's disappointing that I can't, you know, leave my Mac at home and jump back to it at any point in time, you know. So it's kind of a bummer that's gone. I mean, but that said, I've moved on to other tools that do the same thing, right? So what about you guys? You ever use it?
I've never actually used it.
Yeah, I didn't even know it existed. So
really? Oh, wow. Yeah, it's like, it's ancient technology. It's been around for over 10 years, maybe. Like maybe 15 years. I don't know. It's been a long time. I think it might have actually been, I don't know if I want to say it was on Classic Mac as well. Because yeah, I mean, I was doing that kind of stuff back then too. It's been around for a long time. It was cool because it was like, you know, hey, I could leave my computer at home. And so what would happen though with Back to My Mac is you would go to a client or something and you'd plug into their LAN and I would see Carol's computer at home, for instance, right? So I could log onto her computer and then from her computer I could jump onto my home servers or whatever, right? So using screen sharing again, so you could sort of jump around, and it was just like anytime you went to a foreign LAN, as it were, you would see your other Macs would appear in your, you know, in the sidebar of your Finder, right? And you could connect to them, but it was spotty. I mean, like, it sometimes it just didn't work at all, right? So, and then I think when iCloud sort of came into being, they kind of had it piggyback on iCloud, which made it a little bit more seamless. But yeah, I don't think it's a huge loss, to be honest with you.
According to Wikipedia, it was introduced in Leopard.
Leopard, okay, right. And it was one of the, it had to be one of the cats, right? But so Leopard was
10.5.
Was Leopard? Sorry?
10.5 was Leopard.
Oh, I thought it was Tiger. I guess 10.4 was Tiger.
10.13 now, so that was 8 years ago.
Yeah. So I vaguely remember too that, so the Time Capsule came out with at the same time as Tiger, which was 10.4, right? The Time Capsule also played along with that too in terms of using Back to My Mac, because the thing about Back to My Mac too, it also depended on your router, right? If you went to a third party router like Belkin or LinkedIn or D-Link, they didn't understand Back to My Mac at all. So if you had one of those as your main home network, it very seldom worked, and you would get an error saying, oh, go buy a new modem, that one doesn't work, or it doesn't support whatever protocol it was. And of course people are going to yell at their phones, but and we'll follow up next week in terms of what that process, what that protocol was. But you had to, but it was cool what you could also do, things like you could open ports from one app to another and stuff like that. But the Back to My Mac thing was pretty seamless technology. Like it just worked, like typical Apple stuff, right? I mean, when it worked, it just worked. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't foolproof. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, it's considering that it came free with the OS was I mean, that's the bonus, right? But what other pricey tools are these guys talking about? Oh, the other one is screens. You know, that there's a tool from, it's part of the SetApp group, you know, the tool, the apps that we get through SetApp. Now, that comes with a copy of Screens as well, but you can also buy Screens separately. And if you put Screens on your Mac, you can use that to get back to your Mac. Have you guys ever used like Let Me In or there's a number of tools that were out there for being able to have like a server that would be open and transparent and would go to like a third party server and you could get onto your devices. Have you guys ever used those things?
Nope.
No? I haven't, but I've worked at a shop that used Screens by Idovia Software in Montreal. So,
oh, they're from Montreal? Oh, well, cool.
Yeah, or
Go Canada.
The one dude who I think is the entirety of Idovia Software, Luke Vandel. Dude.
What's it called?
Luke Vandel is...
Oh, no, what's the name of the company?
Idovia or Edovia? I'm not sure.
That's Edovia. Okay, yeah. Almost sounds like you're saying Adobe.
And
yeah.
If they're taking full advantage of this, and I wish them well, because the software normally costs $29.99 for macOS, but if, as it says here on their website, if you're looking for a Back to My Mac alternative, save 20% off for a limited time using coupon code RIPBTMM in the checkout. That's $4 right there.
That's hilarious.
$6 because it's $30 US.
Yeah, there's another tool I was just looking at. I think I deleted it off my Mac recently, but let's see if it's still here. It was a German company that used to use software. But I used to, like, when I was in my consulting days as an IT guy, I would. It was about, I want to say, like a couple of $100 to buy this tool. So, I mean, even at $80 for Back to My Mac, you're doing pretty good. Or not Back to My Mac, for Apple Remote Desktop, you're doing pretty good. You know? Yeah, I mean, it's too bad, but I think Apple's probably done the math on it to find out how many people are actually using it, and there probably aren't that many.
Yeah, they're definitely cutting down on things that they don't consider core to the experience. I mean, I think if anything, maybe it'll grow out of like the education market stuff that they're doing and some lightweight MDM stuff that they're doing, but I don't know. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I think if you're in an education market or something like that and you have to get onto your machines anyway, you're probably going to have remote desktop because it's just that much more convenient. Like, you could have a list of devices where, I mean, with Back to My Mac, you always had to have, you know, sort of had to know the passwords to get back and forth and stuff like that. And it's meant for like, you know, consumer level support, or remote desktop. It's robust enough to handle like multiple devices and that kind of stuff, right? Like, you could do things like, I could do things like this. Like, if I wanted to get onto your Mac to do any maintenance on it, I could have like a, what they call a curtain mode, which basically I would close the desktop so you couldn't interact with your own computer, and I could go in and do software updates or tweak, you know, things, and then, you know, open up the curtains and reveal to you your machine again and fix whatever was ailing it, right? And you didn't have to get freaked out by me moving your mouse around and stuff like that, right? So very similar to what Mark and I were talking about doing when we did our pair programming with iChat, right? It was the same. I think it was piggybacking on the same kind of technologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It will be missed. I mean, the curtain facility thing is part of Apple Remote Desktop, just to be clear. Yeah, and actually, I saw the tweets about it online, and so I found out about it when I saw the support document, which I have linked in here, which the title of it is "Prepare for Changes to Back to My Mac," which is their low level way of saying that they're taking it away from us. So,
and changes such as being deleted from your machine.
Yeah, yeah, like it's just not going to be available in macOS Mojave. Sorry.
Doesn't exist anymore. I suppose that's a change.
Yeah. So they're suggesting you use iCloud Drive to access files that you want to share. But then you have to, you know, put them on there before you need them, which is part of the advantage of Back to My Mac, is you didn't have to know that you needed those until you needed them, right? So, yeah. It sucks. Yeah. And they recommend their own tool as well. No discount code, though, folks. All right. So next one, Jaime, you got something about Facebook here?
Yes. Speaking of other things that are going away. Not Facebook itself. Don't get all excited there. Facebook is pulling its VPN app that it had acquired from an Israeli company called Onavo. I'm not sure how that's pronounced.
Oh, really? Is that going away? Huh.
Yeah. Apparently, it has been voluntarily pulled from the App Store, although the sorts of things it was doing in terms of collecting information about the user's device and what they're doing on the internet was a big no-no according to the new App Store rules. So it was claimed here that Apple put the pressure on them to be like, look, you got to remove this or we'll do it for you. But either way, it's not on there anymore. More of an FYI, and also a be careful where you're getting your VPN apps from.
Well, but you know what? So I used to use Anavo when it first came, when I first got my phone, because, you know, back then we were on 3G and, you know, data cost a ton of money and whatever. So what Anavo used to do in the first incarnation of it was it would, I think it would compress or optimize the, I think they used their servers to optimize or compress the data that was coming back and forth between your device and the outside world, right? So I guess, yeah, so you're kind of like parking your data on a third-party server, but, you know, that was a server service that was, you know, welcome back in those early days, right? And I think we talked about this, we've talked about this product before, I think a couple of years ago, because I remember we talked about it, I think after we talked about it on the show, I went in and deleted it off my devices, right? Because I had it on my device, I had it on Carol's devices, I had it on my iPads and stuff like that as well. Because for that same reason, I had, you know, initially installed it to save on data charges, right?
Yeah. Not much else to say about it. It's I believe it is gone from the App Store as of this particular recording. But yeah, again, you know, it seemed like it met a particular need for you, Tim. From what I'm hearing, it worked a little bit like Amazon's Silk browser for like the early editions of the Kindle Fire. I want to say where its web browser would sort of be browsing through Amazon itself and hypothetically would, because, you know, they could heavily cache things across different, not just, you know, different devices for you, but different users of like, oh, look, there's this ping on McDonald.com. All right, well, no sense going all the way to McDonald's CDN. You can just get it from Amazon's. It sounds like Anavo was giving you that sort of capability, and presumably folks were also using it to, you know, access things that are outside of your jurisdiction, like YouTube videos, SNL clips and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that kind of tool. It was more like it would give you a report on, like, you know how we have now, we have the report on how what apps are using your battery and how much, you know, energy they're using, that kind of stuff. It was something like that. It would tell you this, you know, Facebook was using blah blah blah, you know, gigabytes or megabytes or of data, and this is how much we saved you, kind of thing, right? It didn't give you access to anything that you wouldn't normally be able to access. It wasn't like a hot shield, I think it was one of the ones they used to use, and or Tunnel Bear, that kind of thing, right? So because even Charles Proxy is a VPN app, right? They use a VPN technology to capture the logs on your iOS device, right? But it doesn't give you necessarily access to other places. It does stand for virtual private network, but that wasn't the purpose of it, right? It wasn't about watching Netflix or whatever. You they didn't get that facility out of it anyway. Or maybe they did in later versions, but I never used it for that. So yeah, it's just a way of installing a man in the middle to do, you know, certain things for you, right? Knowingly, right? But I guess, you know, any man in the middle is not a good man, good thing to have, right? In retrospect.
It's something to choose carefully, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And that may be why Apple has decided to suggest that they remove it, right? Yeah, violation of store guidelines and data collection. Interesting. Gotta watch the data collection stuff. Yeah. All right. Are we there yet?
I think so.
Pickorama? Hey, let's go around the table like we usually do and talk about, do you have any picks? Is that what I used to say? I forgot. All right. So, Jaime, do you have a pick?
I do. It's a Kickstarter that made its way to us. I think I actually saw it before somebody pointed it out to us online. I apologize.
Oh, but give him the credit. Come on.
Do you have that tweet handy? I don't have that tweet handy to do the attribution.
I'll pull it up while you talk.
Well, you know who you are while Tim's looking that up. Some folks are creating this iconic pillow collection, as they're calling it. And although they never actually say Apple or Mac, if you look at the screenshots in the show notes for those of you driving at home, they have the 1977 pillow, the 1984 pillow, the 1998 pillow, the 2001 pillow, and the 2007 pillow. And if those dates sound familiar to you, that's because those are the release years for very interesting Apple devices. The Apple II, the Mac, the iMac, the iPod, and the iPhone. And yeah, it looks like they're doing pretty good. They're actually above their $10,000 goal at, as of this recording, wow. $54,259. They're not exactly cheap. You know, the cheapest pillow you can buy is one pillow for $39, or you can have all five of them for, I saw this somewhere, it's like $159, I think.
Cool. All right, so the person who sent this to us was Bevan Anderson, creator of AV Plan, EFB, whatever that is. He's a pilot, software developer, father, husband, dog, and cat owner. So let's look at this link here. Let's see what it's AVP. Oh, AV Plan. Oh, so he creates a flight plan app for pilots. That's interesting. on iPad. Hmm, I wonder if my friend Jeff knows about this, because he's been looking for an app like this for a while. Cool. Yeah, and I think I posted a picture of my old my rack of old Macs, and they're not quite as cuddly as these ones, right?
Yeah, they look pretty good. I mean, they show them on the couch. They would definitely make a statement if you have them in your living room.
Yeah, they look kind of nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you were to get only one, because they're not exactly cheap, but $39 a pop, which one would you get and why?
Which one would I get? I would probably go for the original Mac.
I would too.
Yeah. I mean, the iMac's kind of cool, but, you know, the Bondi Blue, is it Bondi Blue or Bondi Blue? Bondi Blue, I guess, right? Somebody corrected us on the podcast.
I almost want to get the iPhone one, but it's a little boring compared to the others.
The Apple II's not bad too, though, right?
Yeah. Yep.
It's kind of, they're a bit close about the Apple II, but...
I wouldn't get the Apple II because in those days, I was on the other side. I was on the Atari side, and the Apple II was the enemy in some sense.
Interesting that they didn't do the Apple, like the rainbow stripes in an Apple icon kind of shape. I guess they were concerned about
copyright infringement, probably.
Huh. Yeah, but I think anybody would. It's got like the floppy slot and the grills on the side. Cool.
Yeah, I think I would have gotten the iMac pillow, largely because I really remember that design a lot, even though I didn't own one, but we did have them at the school computer lab, so definitely used them a lot.
The iMac one?
Mm-hmm.
They should have made a cube.
Yeah, that's a good thing. It's like not it's not all comprehensive, right? It's sort of like they're the largest products that came out.
Yeah.
Like they don't have a Lisa one, for example.
That's true.
Or G4 cheese grater one.
Little Apple Watch.
Yeah, right.
and Mark's right, like the phone one would probably be more meaningful to me in terms of, you know, what do I actually do, what do I actually own.
But it's kind of dull compared to the rest.
Yeah, because it's just a black rounded rectangle. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're just holding it wrong on me.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Interesting. Cool. Yeah, Carol has an I haven't showed this to Carol yet, but she's an embroidery machine. She could probably do something like this too. All right. My pick is kind of interesting. So I don't know if you guys have ever done this before, but like so in and this comes through via Joshua Green, one of the guys from the Ray Wunderlich group, who tweeted about this, that he'd found an article by Oleg Begman that talks about how to use the text macros that are built in to iOS 9 to create your own file headers. One company I work at, we just removed them all together, but you know how when you create a new file in Xcode and it puts the name of the file class itself, the name of the project created by, and usually your name, you know, the name of the person who's using the Mac, and a date of some type, and then some sort of copyright, and you can change this stuff yourself, you know, like in your Xcode projects and stuff like that. But there's a plist in there called an IDE template macros plist that you can go in and set up different use the different properties to set up the header the way you want it to appear, right? So you can, you know, have the project name .xcode and using other different data, project data, workspace user, so on and so forth. And he's also in the article here that's linked in the show notes for basically a plist that you can edit even in Xcode if you wanted, just using, you know, the built-in plist editor that they have there, ugly as it is. But he's also got a link here in this article to all the text macros that are available in Xcode. So, you know, we've got date and, you know, file header, file name, full username. It goes on and on. And so he's listed off here what each one of these parameters do. So if you're always been curious about how this header gets created, or you want to make your own, like for instance, the Ray Wunderlich group that I write for, we always, in our code, we always have to put a big legal disclaimer at the top of it. And, you know, we were copying and pasting like an animal before this, but now I guess we can set up these macros to do, or when we're building our tutorial material, we can build in the appropriate copy material. And also, if you ever get source code from Apple, you'll notice that they've got like a page and a half of a disclaimer on top of their code, and you might get like four lines of code in the sample class that you, or sample Swift file or whatever that you're using in their example. But so if you're ever curious about building out your own header, this is a great tool that you now have at your avail to do that. Comments?
Cool stuff.
Yeah, I didn't know that this is how people did that. I'd always wondered how people had customized one.
Well, this is new in Xcode 9, but yeah, I think people might have been doing it, you know, under the covers before, right? I know I've like, you know, when I'm working on a tutorial for Ray, I've gone in and changed my identity in Xcode, and it applies to everything everything I do at that point until I go back and change it later, you know, so it's kind of a pain, but, or I would just copy and paste, you know, from another file and commit that into the change and all that kind of stuff. But this is, you know, if you don't like the default template or default styling that comes out, you can customize and create your own. That's cool. Yeah, it looks like until now, this is he's saying that is because of Xcode 9 now allows you to customize the file header and other so-called text macros using a plist. So like other people, like, yeah, I think you've probably always been able to go in and find the chunk of code inside your Xcode its file itself and like the actual application and get into the contents and tweak them. But this is now available to us to use. And this is as of July 20th, 2017. So it's been out there for a year, right? Mm-hmm. But that's my pick, such as it is.
There are always so many of these little tidbits about Xcode and how you do stuff that feels like an evergreen topic to talk about.
Well, you know, there's a book that just came out about that, Jaime.
Tell me more, Tim.
It's called Xcode Treasures, and it's by Chris Adamson on the Pragmatic Programmer, Pragmatic Press, what do they call themselves? And I think it's just, about to be released. I think it's in beta 7 or 8 right now, but and so if you buy it now, you can get it at a discount price. And it's edited by our own co-host, sometimes co-host, Tammy Coron. So yeah, go out there and get it. And then it'll tell you all kinds of things about Xcode. I may or may not have read it. Okay, I read it.
Or what little there was of it already. So
yeah, it looks pretty interesting. It's got covers off quite a few things about Xcode. Shall I tell you more?
Sure.
Or do you care? Let me find my notes. Let's see. Yeah, it covers app versioning, talks about alternate views, talks about arbitrary objects, storyboard references in the library, all kinds of debugging insights, right? So, yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's it for the week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you on the interwebs, where would they do that?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
All right. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
Mark R. at smapsoft.com.
All right. Again, as I say at the top of the show every time, my name is Tim Mitra. I'm TimMitra on the Twitter machine. I will be attending 360 iDev. So by the time this episode is published, I should be in Denver. And so if you're coming to 360 iDev, look me up, look Tammy up, and we'll take a selfie with you. I might have some t-shirts with me and some stickers. So maybe you can get some of those from me. But until next time, we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find out details on how to help us out on the website, mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Now stick around for the after show, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
So are you giving a talk at 360 iDev?
No, I'm not. They turned me down.
Really?
Turned me down. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I was going to do a talk on neuroplasticity and, you know, how to, because I've been using those techniques that I learned in writing that article about, you know, learning after 50. So I wanted to learn a few songs recently, and I've been using the same processes like that I talked about a few weeks ago when I covered it on the show, where basically you do short sessions as opposed to just doing big, long marathon ones. And not cramming you know, do a little bit today and a little bit tomorrow and a little bit, you know, after that. And so like for one of the songs that we used to play in the band all the time was Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin. Right. And it's sort of a blues, but it's a vamp, right? There's a little progression that they play.
Yep.
And I used to know it but I was always singing. So I used to just play the straight chords. Right. But the other guys in the band would all play it. Right. And then, we used to segue from Johnny B. Goode into Rock and Roll, but that's another story. But and I'd forgotten the progression, and so I started. You know, I found one of the instructors that I like on YouTube, and he kind of walks through it really slowly. And so I basically just started practicing it, and you know, every couple of days, you know, first day I kind of had it, and then of course, you know, like as I said before, that's a chemical bond in your brain, and those get lost pretty quickly. Like you feel like you're making progress and stuff like that, but it's a chemical thing, and then so you have to come come back at it, you know, the next day and try a little bit more and again day after day after day until it becomes a structure in your brain. And then that's why it's easier to remember over time. And then once you've got it figured out, then it becomes a behavior. So like if I was playing with my band, if we played the song with the band every week, it would become a behavior kind of thing, right? And then I could just play it whenever I wanted kind of thing, you know, so...
Can we wait until the smoke clears?
Well, that's supposed to clear starting tomorrow afternoon.
Really?
So we're getting this double, like triple whammy. Quadruple, maybe? There were fires coming from Canada.
I'm starting the recording again, by the way.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay, before I get snarky, let me resume recording. Yeah, so the smoke and ash.
Canadians, right?
Clouding up the sky in Seattle. Yes, a whole bunch of it coming from Canada. So thank you to Canada for that. Oregon had some sort of fires. Washington State had its own fires in the Cascades, I think. And so, California has had fires.
They were saying today that it's sort of the new normal for summer out there. I guess the lightning starts the fires or something like that, or...
Yeah, I guess so. It's just so dry. I mean, I understand why California, because they've had droughts since forever, but it seems like it's spreading to the Pacific Northwest as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's surprising, because you guys are like almost a rainforest there, right? Like, you're that side of the Rockies, right? I mean,
the west side?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
The other side.
I mean, we do get stuff like raspberries, blueberries, that sort of thing. Blackberries, they just grow like weeds. You don't even have to water them, because it's so moist here.
Right. Oh, yeah, normally. But is it dry now? Now, or
been a pretty dry summer, that's for sure. Not as much rain as you would normally expect.
Yeah, it's funny, here we're getting flooding because I mean, like, we get these rainstorms that are just dumps down gallons of rain at a time, you know, like your backyard will flood and then that's gone. But like in some of the places like downtown Toronto, where they have all these underground paths and stuff like that, and the subways and things like that, they've been filling up with water as well, right? All the storm, and it's just like all of a sudden all this water just dumps down, and I guess it runs across the city and collects in these low-lying areas, right? Like, there's pictures online of... So we have some underpasses that go underneath railway tracks and stuff like that, and you'll see, like, streetcars up to the windows in water, right? So
just stuck.
And it's just all of a sudden this is the... And they're saying this is what our weather, our summer rain is going to be like from now on, right? So just these crazy thunderstorms in the middle of the summer, right? There's no climate change. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Oh, of course not. Of course not.
Oh, fake news. So what else is going on? Not much going on in the world of Apple, I guess, right? Are we waiting for an announcement like to be set up in the first second week of September? Is that what we're waiting for?
Yeah, we haven't seen the invite yet.
A couple of announcements coming up. Hmm. We just had earnings.
Right.
So yeah, any day now we should be hearing about there should be an iPhone announcement. There should be apparently there's going to be an Apple Watch announcement.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that was first announced in October, the Apple Watch, right?
Mm. Maybe they'll do them at the same time.
Yeah. No.
Still waiting for that HomePod 2 to come out.
Yeah, that had surprisingly good sales at the earnings call, right? The HomePod?
Did it? I don't know. I didn't dig that deeply into it.
Yeah, I vaguely remember it was... Well, we looked at some numbers and it seemed to be better than we anticipated, right?
Mm. Yeah, considering we saw that thing about selling one per day or something. Yeah. One per store per day, something like that.
Right, yeah. How was Apple's stock price doing today?
I don't know. It's sort of funny seeing the analysis go through where, remember, not that long ago, it was, oh my God, Apple's doomed because the iPhone X is not selling well. In fact, it's doing so poorly, they're just going to cancel it. And now it's, actually, it did so well that Apple is equally doomed because nobody's going to buy an iPhone in the fall since the iPhone X has pulled demand forward into last year.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Apple stock's like, what, up to 15 or something like that today?
Yeah, it hit 217 a couple days ago.
Yeah, that's pretty high. Yeah, even after that Facebook dip, right? So how's Facebook doing? Yeah, Facebook's up. They had that, remember they had they're not up. They were up around 217. They're now at 173. So they're quite a bit lower. So in July, a month ago, they were at 217 and they dropped down to 173. How's Twitter doing? They're just moving along. Yeah, that ski slope seemed to affect Twitter as well. I wonder why Apple got away with that. I guess Apple's not, you know, playing with people's privacy, so they didn't have that big drop, right?
Yeah, they're definitely coming out a little bit cleaner than, I mean, because they, I mean, we talked about the fact that they had pulled most of the podcasts for the InfoWars folks.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about the fact that Apple doesn't quite have that same relationship with advertisers and communities as Facebook, Twitter, and Google via YouTube.
Right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, but is Twitter still public?
publishing that guy's stuff, right? Aren't they?
So it might have changed since then, but after sort of really, really dropping the ball in terms of, you know, you had an easy opportunity. Everybody else was banning this guy. Go ahead and ban him too. They held their ground. I'm sure everybody was pointing out how stupid that was.
Yeah.
And then they just waited for some little thing, because I'm sure they said, all right, look, we didn't ban him before, but just wait like 2 days and surely he will do something that violates our terms of service. And yep, they jumped on it as soon as they could.
Oh yeah.
But sort of reactively and after the fact and after, you know, all the bad PR has come out about it.
Right.
You know, regardless of what you think about their responsibilities as a platform or as, you know, folks who like to think very highly of themselves, they just dropped it like completely. Like you couldn't drop the ball any further. It would be in the center of the earth.
Wow. Yeah. Craziness.
It's got people all excited on Twitter about, simultaneously, there's also the fact that the APIs were finally cut off for like push notifications and other things for third parties. I forget what it is we said. That
Facebook
it was.
Or Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
So I forget what the third party ones are. Like Twitterific, I'm going to say, is probably still around. Like they lost the ability to do push notification stuff. So they're basically just polling to see when you have new content now, which is an okay workaround, I guess.
Yeah.
But the combination of that plus the InfoWars thing has caused a resurgence of people all over the interwebs and in blogs and tweets and podcasts talking about, oh, like, I'm moving to Mastodon. I'm doing stuff.
Yeah, I was going to mention it. I was going to ask you about Mastodon because, you know, I discovered it last year when we were talking. Last year we were talking about it at 360 iDev, right? And it's I don't know. I'm still a little flummoxed about how to use it. I don't see that it's, you know, an easy Twitter replacement.
So that's a good description of it, Tim, because I was about to say, what if you had app.net but made it even more difficult to get started? Now, how much would you pay?
Yeah. Are you on Mastodon?
I'm not. And
you're not? No. See, I am.
After going through this exercise on app.net, I'm going to wait until until I look foolish for not being on it, because...
Yeah, I don't know. Have you heard, is there an iOS client? They don't have one, whoever runs Mastodon, right? Or that I've seen, anyway.
It's like a whole federated thing, so I assume it's sort of like getting like a domain name and getting an email address at a domain name where it's portable just about everywhere you might want to be, but also doesn't benefit from the nice things that centralization give you, like
so how to find people, how to find communities. Mastodon.social is an instance of it, or?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask for that because I'm almost certainly going to get it wrong, but I think it might be like a directory system, perhaps, to the other federated systems.
Right.
Kind of thinking
about
it.
I've heard people, I think you can run your own instance of it if you want, like you can, and then join the network or whatever, right? Like a web server.
And there must be some sort of portability of like your information. Otherwise, it would be like, how is this any different than just having your own blog and letting people, or your own BBS forum and letting people post there? There must be something that's a little bit easier than I'm making it sound like, but it's also still not quite as easy as just sign up for a Twitter account and go and follow Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, here, look, so let's look at this. So I've got, I've joined it. I joined it last year, and I've got Carl from Taco is following me. James Thompson follows me. Some guy named John Fricker, Gazola, Rene Fukwe. He's one of our listeners on the show. Gene McDonald, Tom Harrington, and let's see. Ish is following me. Ash Furrow is following me. And Jorge Ortiz is following me. So, yeah. Woohoo.
Yeah, so I think I'm like I said, I'm gonna think I'm gonna wait this one out and, you know, see that it gets to some critical mass and then say, all right, I'm starting to look foolish now for not being on Mastodon and get started then.
Yeah.
Or if I wait long enough, maybe it ends up going away like app.net, right? Like if it exists at all, app.net, that is, there's almost certainly somebody masquerading as me right now just because I'm not posting on there anymore.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird because like there's this group local timeline you can look at, and it's basically just, you know, everybody, I don't know what local means, like local to me, local like within my vicinity, but it's just like a stream of like craziness, right? And there's a world feed, there's that federated timeline. The federated timeline is just like, I guess, everybody around the world. There's a lot of Chinese and, you know, foreign language content coming up, and it's just constantly flying by, right? Like, I don't even know how you can follow it. Some guy named Fiesel Zappa? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't know. It's not...
I have my home feed, I guess. That's so I've got see a lot of tweets here from Ash Furrow. He seems to be pretty active. But yeah, not much happening over here yet. But I think, like you said, I've seen a few people on my Twitter say that there's not a lot of, like, they're hedging their bets too, right? They're waiting to see.
I feel like we should ask Greg if he's on Mastodon or not.
Yeah.
That'll be my bellwether.
Yeah. Well, you were at 360i Dev and you didn't even sign up last year, right? Because that's when Jay, what's his name? The guy behind Cydia, did that talk.
Oh, right. I'm sure I could look it up, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's talking about, you know, why be on these, you know, open social networks so people, everybody can sort of see you kind of thing, right? Come over to Mastodon. Water's fine, I guess. Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't created a MTJC identity over there yet. I don't know if you can do that on Mastodon. I don't know if you can do companies or whatever. If it's just has to be individuals or what have you. I guess you can, right?
That would be kind of interesting because it just feels like this ends up running into all the same problems that Facebook and Twitter have faced where, do you need to use your real identity? There's pros for it. There's cons against it.
Yeah.
Can you do, you know, company or group type stuff? You know, is that an identity that's allowed? And you just talked about your timeline, such as it is, being somewhat weird to you. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll be like, well, what if we surfaced, you know, things we thought were more important to you?
Right.
And then you're a hop, skip, and a jump away to a fully algorithmic timeline. And then people are getting really angry at how it's getting abused. So then they got to try to fix that. And then they're banning people. And then somebody creates, I don't know, mammoth.social as a way to counteract that and just fragments further.
Yeah. Well, it looks like Ashfro hasn't been here on Twitter in 4 days. I guess he's gone over to Mastodon. I don't know. It's a bit like, Amsterdam, you know, sort of idea. Like, let's go over here and start a whole new world, right?
It sounds good. Like, you can make a utopia. And then, like, the first 80% of the stuff you would need to do is relatively low-hanging fruit. It's relatively straightforward to get done. Not to say that it's not a lot of work and that there aren't challenges, but it's that final 20%, maybe that final 10%. Yeah. That's the real killer.
Or hey, back. I'll follow back some people and see if I get any action out of their connections here. Follows me. How do I follow her? I've added all these people. I'm not following them, and I still see no action on my timeline. It's going really well, I think, Jaime, for, you know, first week. Although I've been on it for a year. Sigh.
People are really just going to find out that technology isn't really the problem. Certainly, it doesn't help in some cases. You know, certain product directions that Facebook and Twitter and Google and stuff have made. Mm-hmm. It's really people that are the main problem. And all you can do is just sort of create all new and exciting ways for people to be terrible to each other.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny. I don't know, like your senior people of your family are like, but you know, I've been talking to a few people on Facebook and stuff like that, and none of them are on Twitter that I can find. You know, like, you know, they're on Instagram, they're on Facebook, but this seems to be this stigma about social networks that people just kind of avoid them, right? They just don't bother with them. But then that may be a generational thing, right? Like, I don't know, Mark, what about your friends and stuff like that? Are they all on these things at all, as well? Or?
Very few people that I know use any of that stuff.
Very few people. Yeah.
Yep. Seems to be bigger the further east you go. It's, I mean, Twitter was huge around here like 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And now nobody I know uses it.
Right. And Facebook certainly, in my opinion, gone downhill big time, at least since I joined it anyway. Lately, it's been really hard to use, but yeah, it's disappointing. So, Jaime, what about you? Like, do your colleagues and friends use it, or use the networks?
To varying degrees. It's in between. There's some folks who are on all the time, it seems, and others who seem to be using it largely as I do, mostly read-only, occasional upload some photos or post some interesting article.
Yeah. I'd be curious to find out how many of our listeners are actually find us through on Twitter or Facebook. Facebook, I would say very few, but Twitter, I wonder. Or do they just... I'm curious how people found the podcast, you know, if they weren't using social networks to do it. Because, I mean, we don't get a lot of traffic on our website, per se.
Maybe through iTunes?
Yeah, I don't know. Or word of mouth.
Yeah, if you search for iOS development, still number one.
Yeah. But think about it, though. If you were looking for a podcast, is that how you would look for it?
Not really, no. I would probably search on Google.
Yeah. Well, what happens on Google if you type in... podcast iOS development or iOS podcast?
Oh, that's going to be a hard one because it's going to show you results that are relevant to you.
Yeah, you think?
And if you're signed in like I am, it's almost certainly going to show ours. Let's see.
10 best podcasts for iPhone users. Best iOS podcasts for iOS developers. Let's see what we got in here. Medium article. Under the Radar. Inside iOS Dev. iOS Dev Break. Swift by Sandell.
Yep.
More Than Just Code. Woohoo! Swift Unwrapped, Swift Coders, iFreaks, Worst Case Scenario, Learn Swift Podcast, Release Notes, Fireside, RaveWonderlick.com, Podcast, Shared Instance, Fatal Error, Accidental Tech, iDeveloper Podcast, Super Top Podcast, Consult Podcast, The Talk Show with John Gruber, Build Phase, App Guy, App Store. And this is from, when is this from? It doesn't say. I thought Medium would, March 1st. Is that, I guess that's this March 1st? Well, there you go. We showed up there.
Yeah, maybe this is how people find us. They do a search and then they get this sort of thing.
Here's another one from Swift with Justin. My favorite iOS podcast. Oh, top pick. Mark Morton just goes, woo!
Hooray!
Under the radar. We got to thank these people. iOS. I think iOS is gone, right? Or stopped publishing. Release Notes, Core Intuition. So. Honorable Mentions, RayWonderlick.com, Concepts and Code. Cool. Let's tweet this guy. I should do it as Morton just Code. No, I can't do it as Morton just Code. I hate this tool. All right, we'll just tweet it. There we go. All right, that's one. That's the last one I just looked at. Medium, right? So you can go in there and thank these tweet people. I mean, Medium have a tweet button on their thing? Yes, they do. They're on Twitter. Oh, it's just a little shame. We're just actually doing research on this, right? Great podcasts for iOS developers. Number three. What did you find when you did the search, or did you do the search?
I don't know how to describe this. Like, the call out for it was that best iOS development podcast for app developers. Probably the same one that you're looking at.
Yeah, I see that one. It's like number five on my list.
So I got one from Mike Buss here, and it's Core Intuition, NS Brief, Accidental Tech, Developing Perspectives, iFreaks, Springboard, iOS, App Story, Discontinued. Oh, then he's got listed Discontinued.
Yeah, look at the date or the
it's 2014.
The URL. Oh, really? Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yes, yeah, like before we even started. So, yeah, okay. Bad choice. But here's one from Player FM. I'm going to bring up. Have you got any results there, Jaime, other than what I'm talking about?
Let's see. Here's another one. This is a user on GitHub, Vermont 42, podcast repo. Person is from California, and we show up. Oh, this is in alphabetical order, so it's hard to say what number we are.
Well, I found another one here called Player FM Podcast. I don't even know who they are. It's like a player, like a podcatcher, and we're listed number one there, along with iOS Dev Break.
This one's pretty nice in terms of the way it breaks things down. It says...
Well, it's interesting. When I click on Player FM, we're not listed at all.
Really?
Yeah.
2018? That link? Best iOS Podcast 2018?
Player.fm/podcast/iOS.
Oh, so what search did you criteria? I put iOS Dev Podcast in my Google.
Oh, I just put an iOS podcast. Oh,
okay. Yeah, well, iOS is just going to give you devices, right?
Well, it gave me that previous one, Best Podcast for Mac for App Developers.
Here's one on Quora. Question is, what are the best podcasts for iOS development? Under the Radar, iOS Dev Podcast, iOS Dev Break, Swift by Sundell, and Swift Coders. Oh, well, didn't make that list.
When I type in iOS Dev Podcast, the Mike Bus one shows up first, and he didn't list us.
Well, it's because that's March 14, 2014. We didn't exist then. We weren't even a glint in Jaime's parents' eyes at that point.
Oh, there's that my favorite, spelled with a U, iOS development podcast by Swift with Justin, where we're first.
Yeah, I saw that one. So here's another one.
Although he says in no particular order.
Here's one, Global Nerdy, Joey Villa's Tech Mobile, a list of iOS development progress, September 2016 edition. So this is 2 years old, and he's got the App Guy podcast, App Masters, Build Phase, Concepts and Code, Core Intuition, it's alphabetical, iOS Bytes, iOS, iOS, iFreaks, More Than Just Code podcast, RayWonderlick.podcast, Release Notes, and Under the Radar. So we were on the list in 2016. We didn't even know about. Mm. What do you know?
This one that I'm looking at, it's a GitHub users list, has an interesting stat here. It has average length for these various podcasts.
This the GitHub Vermont 42.
Yeah. It says our average length is 1 hour, 31 minutes, and 26 seconds.
Hmm. That's good to know. Accidental Tech is 139. All things Git. Oh, this is alphabetical, right? But we're on the list, though. That's good.
We're on the list.
Woohoo. That's all that matters. So now I got to try and see if I can keep the average up.
I think the longest one I've seen so far is the talk show, which is an hour 56. What is it? Hour 56 and 40 seconds.
Yeah, I think we've had one or two episodes that were that long around there. Greg was all excited once because I think one time our after show was longer than the actual show. Yeah, well, that's cool.
All right. Speaking of that, we're approaching 2 hours now.
All right, so we should duck out.
I think I'm gonna head off.
Head off into the sunset. All right, folks, we'll talk to you guys later.
All right.
Bye. Later.
Bye. Have fun in Denver, Tim.
I'll try. Talk to you later.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.